Ed Bile, December 13th, 1973 in Chapel Hill.
In a sense, look at some of the major assumptions or hypotheses that Key had. One was that you understood the politics of race, you understood the politics of the South. But in his book, North Carolina was always considered sort of the exception as a progressive plutocracy. So, first of all, I wanted you to comment on that. And secondly, just comment on that.
One was Key right.
Yeah.
About North Carolina, what you said about North Carolina being
my off the top of the head guess is that he, like John Gunther, was probably seduced by Chapel Hill and Frank Porter Graham, and then that the implications of that into the press. If you look at Gunther's chapter on North Carolina, so much of it is key to Frank Porter Graham and Chapel Hill being the bastion in the South. Most of the evidence seems to indicate that that wasn't really true. There, for some reason, North Carolina has a better national image, an elite-type image, than when you get here and really dig down below and take opinion samples of what the people are really thinking about and then look at all the objective indicators of what government is producing here. You know, we do come out 47, 48, 49 consistently on just about everything you can get. Yet, at the same time, you got that progressive plutocracy, Sanford, Dixie Dynamo, you know, all these things. Time magazine picks him up and he's, you know, the vanguard of the South and so forth. So I guess I don't really buy his hypothesis. I've never been able to figure out why it got where it is. You know, or why the image of North Carolina is such a liberal or moderate.
Because if that were the case, then how do you explain 1972 presidential primary here? How do you explain Jesse Helms?
Yeah. And I don't see them as really aberrations.
You don't?
No. I mean, I don't think a lot of people moved away from Sanford. Just the other day, we looked at what was Terry's percentage of the Democratic vote in 1960 first primary. He got 41%. In 1972, he got 37%, which is not a hell of a big shift. He'd been out of politics for a while, and there were a lot of reasons for people pulling away from him, not the least of being George Wallace, but not looking at him as a serious candidate. What's he doing this, and sales tax, Terry, that sort of thing.
Let me ask you this question about the Sanford Wallace thing. This is just another point. I don't really have any feeling about it. I think it's kind of interesting. You can only ask, answer it probably by opinion, but you're in a position to have some informed opinion on it. And that is, did Sanford's entrance into the presidential primary against Wallace have an adverse effect on the Democratic statewide slate because of, particularly in eastern North Carolina, because of voter perception that somehow Sanford, symbol of the Democratic Party in North Carolina, was against George Wallace, and therefore a reaction to that?
I guess that is probably true, but I don't know to what extent. I would guess if you had plumbed it right at that point, I don't know if you picked that up, my guess would be that would be part of it. Certainly the running backwards of all the candidates from this race, not picking him up as a favorite son or anything would suggest that they felt this was going to happen.
But that then suggests in this forthcoming meeting of George Wallace, sponsored by North Carolina Democratic Party, is a good unity move?
Yes, it would be, yeah. And just look at the press coverage of that, of the Sanford Wallace race. None of the major papers came out very strongly. Matter of fact, sort of the tenor was, they're both pretty good guys, but Terry's a better good guy. And they didn't want to, you know, attack Wallace, except for the News and Observer, and Claude Sitton did go down and write those four lengthy, let's look at Wallace's record. And don't know if you remember, but there was great vitriol in the letters to the editor on the basis of sitting, taking that those stands, and you know, trying to document.
I wasn't familiar with the column about sitting.
Well, he went down and, you know, said, you know, Wallace.
You don't have copies of it.
No, I don't.
You don't think that 1972 was an aberration in terms of the presidential primary, but what about the general election?
I see that as sort of a unique confluence of influences. Well, there's several hypotheses. That would be one. That you, if you were in the Republican, if you were the Republican ticket maker, you couldn't have done a better job of putting together the top of the ticket than having a Helms, a Holzhauser, and a Nixon, and especially a Nixon. Then also, if you could just dabble in Democratic politics and put a McGovern, you couldn't have done a hell of a lot better. And the question is, has this really unhinged some things so that people aren't going to move over, you know, start really registering Republican, voting Republican down the ballot? You just don't know how stable these things are.
You think the legislative elections in 74 would be a good indicator on that?
Yeah, if the Republicans don't really make much of a move there, I think that would be one indicator. I also think the 76 council state and congressional elections will be important. I think
76 or 74?
76. Maybe in 74, I'm not sure.
But 74 congressional
elections. That's going to be hard to say. I think the reason I say 76 is that by then, Holzhauser will have run through the Council of State and are his secretaries that he can appoint. You know, X number of bright young Republicans who will get name identification, or at least people will know who they are, and they will have some sort of a record in state government, and they can then take on the Thad Buehrs and the Ed Gills, and probably the Democrats can be in deep trouble if they just let the old guard run vis-a-vis some of these younger guys who can make them really look kind of
But do they
adequate.
Have any choice?
No,
do you see anybody emerging?
Who, in the Democratic
the
side?
Democratic Party?
At the congressional level or at the gubernatorial level? No.
How do you assess the North Carolina Democratic Party at this time?
I don't really have a sense of it. I think we're back where there is no, you know, the 60s and into the 72 election was really dominated by, as I understand it, the basic Sanford coalition. At least everybody who was running in 72 or thinking about running had come out of and worked with Sanford in one way or another. They even got Bobby Morgan to fly up to New Jersey, you know, and lay the paper on the attorney there.
So-called Sanford coalition or machine, whatever you want to call it.
Did you get
the one thing that you hear about when you come to North Carolina is the tremendous impact that administration had on the state, both in terms of the policies of the state as well as the politics of it. Yet, in the 72 presidential election, primary election, you say you got, what, 38% of the vote. Is there a machine? Is there an organization?
Is this
a fiction?
No, there was a machine. There were, you know, laughingly, he would point to four attaché cases in which they were all county by county, who gave, who ran it, who got out the vote, and that was his machine in a sense. But that machine wasn't really geared up. I think probably Pryor used it a little bit. I don't think it was really geared up again. There were flickers at it in 68, I think, when he was thinking run against Urban.
But are there a large group of people in the state who identify with him and look to him for leadership?
Not as much as he would like to think. I think there are some political leaders who do read a path through his door, or at least the side door, the back door, and talk to him about what's going on and whether they should go this direction or that direction. At least this is what, you know, from hearsay evidence, I haven't been there checking, but I do know that he does talk to people like
Skipper. How do you assess the Sanford administration in its impact?
On North Carolina?
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, it's colored by several things. One would be the sales tax issue and how that impacted on everybody. Another would be the whole racial question, which really exploded under him, and you really have to go back and think in terms of what Luther Hodges did for the state, I think. by being governor for 6 years, the only governor that we've had for 6 years, but those were critical years, 54, after the Brown decision, all the way through 60, we had no statewide race in which, you know, like what happened in Arkansas and various other southern states, where you could get the race issue out front, in front of all the state electorate, so that it all impacted on 60. Sanford, even by most objective indicators and most people I've talked to, was considered at least a moderate segregationist in his campaign. So he fell there.
What? He used that rhetoric in the campaign.
Yeah, but he did weather that racial storm fairly well. But I think the combination of the racial thing and the sales tax hurt him in terms of. It's really hard for me to say what he did. You know, he put a lot of money in education. I think there's a lot of drive. There's a lot of force in his governor's office and throughout state government. You can sort of feel it. I came in at the end, so it was beginning to taper off as people lined up either for Pryor or for Moore or for Lake. So I missed a lot of that. But I could tell the difference when the Moore administration came in as opposed to the Sanford administration had gone out, the difference in style and push.
What was the difference in style?
You could just sense it. It was... One thing I do remember is when I go in and talk to Sanford, it was usually me and Sanford and maybe someone like Joel or somebody like that, younger folks. The first time I went to see Governor Moore, seated on the back couch was Ed Gill. And when we were talking about some sort of decision that had to be made, Moore very obviously looked over to him to get the signal as to which way he should go, because I had presented the issue on either this or that basis. And he looked over, got the nod from the old guy. Well, right here was just a whole style question, difference. I could see who was involved in the decision very differently than decisions before. Moore himself.
But did that have a real impact on state policy during that 4 years?
Well, on the Moore administration?
Style?
I think at the top it did, and I think the Moore administration was much more like what the state government was used to.
You know, what about Scott following him? Is it the same for that?
Scott was more towards Terry. Moore admittedly said that he would probably be a Republican now, consider himself as a Republican as opposed to being a Democrat, and found no problem with being so labeled. The Scott administration really picked up some of the Sanford support and then some of the Lake support.
Well, some of that was typically the old Car Scott support from Lake.
But he directly fished for that. Somewhere is mine, I think, here.
I guess we split this one. Yeah. What'd you order?
I think this must be.
Is it one of these rolls?
It could be. I think I got one. Did you want one or two?
I want one.
Okay, then I'll take one.
The sauce. Split that. Well, if you think back to 1948, which administration stand out in terms of style, A, and B, in terms of really making an impact on state policies, in terms of education, highways, and so on?
Yeah, I think obviously, well, not being here, it's hard for me to say. The Scott administration, the first Scott administration, obviously made a tremendous impact on roads, the breakthrough there. The Hodges administration, I think, had an impact on the racial question in the sense that it kept it from blowing open. And then there were some very businesslike things that they did. Reorganizing, getting business in, not being super political. Sanford, pretty much in education. Moore gets a blank, which I think is a bit unfair. It's sort of like Eisenhower at the national level after X years of the New Deal. I think there's some things he did that were just overlooked. He defused the whole speaker ban controversy and some things like that. These aren't.
But
things.
Isn't that pretty? Don't people tend to view that as kind of a coasting? Or
yeah. It's very hard. We had him into class, and before and after, talking to him, reading everything about him, we had a very hard time trying to say, well, what was he all about? And
so of a caretaker.
Yeah, he was a caretaker. He called his reign total development, and no one ever understood what that meant. He said it meant that he wanted every agency in state government to develop to its potential. And a lot of other people thought it was total development of the state, as opposed to state government agencies. Scott, education, higher education. I don't think his other side of planning will ever, you know, that's just not one of those things that people get too excited about. But he felt is very important.
But well, from what you know, that you would say that Karska and Sanford's administration stand out
mm-hmm.
in terms of style
mm-hmm.
and also in terms of results.
How about in terms of lasting impact?
I guess then I would have to sneak Luther Hodges in and say that there was some lasting impact there in terms of, in the sense that the state didn't, this again goes back to the racial question, the state didn't get torn apart during the time that other states were getting torn apart.
Yeah, but when the racial question was posed, it did get torn apart, didn't it?
Yes.
It wasn't posed from 54 to 60.
But in 63, 62, 63, it was.
And also in 72.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't that also
wasn't that?
The distinction between the Upper South and Deep South?
Yeah.
South Carolina wouldn't get torn apart. It wouldn't
be the next state. That's all the other. It just goes back to that initial question about, you know, is North Carolina really a deep South state or a mid-South state or whatever? You know, Key saying that it's really a progressive plutocracy in which raced the enlightened leadership of the state. I don't know, he's got that several times in there.
We've run across the hypothesis that there's two reasons why we didn't see the racial thing surface as much in other states. One was that it really wasn't brought to a head. There really were no contests where you could say, this is a clear racial vote.
Mm-hmm.
Second was that the leadership of the Democratic Party kept it that way. It kept the situation from becoming one where the candidates in the primaries or other situations represented race. Well, I mean, that's such a concern of the party.
In the sense that North Carolina being dominated by business establishment basically who perceived racial turmoil as a threat to stability.
Right.
And presumably perceived it all along as that. Bad racially, bad for business. Plus the fact they're certainly not threatened over the fact that people like voting here and there. Racial issue was just more suppressed in North Carolina, historically.
Mm-hmm.
And the second question on that, and that is looking at North Carolina today at what has transpired in going election helms, Wallace showing in the primary, defeated those two guys who didn't vote for the Southern Manifesto, Graham's defeat, all the whole pretty consistent pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some question as to whether or not North Carolina today is as far advanced as some of the other states. The question being that North Carolina hasn't changed as much as other states in the South.
I think that's, I agree with that.
And to some extent because the issue was more muted here and hasn't undergone the trauma.
I agree. I no disagreement. You know, Governor Scott may have been about as moderate as Carter, Bumpers, Askew, West, and Holton. He may not have been, but he certainly didn't get the press they did because everybody sort of expected him, you know, the North Carolina governor to say the things he did. And they didn't. They were completely dumbfounded when, you know, people like Carter in Georgia and these other West and South Carolina come out and say, you know, that series of gubernatorial addresses that sort of put this foursome or fivesome among Southern governors out way out in front. even the voter, you can go back to the voter education project data in 58 versus 68 or 70, you can see that, you know, North Carolina was furthest ahead. They weren't that far ahead. But then by 68, all the other states had gone by, and North Carolina shows it towards the bottom in terms of number of blacks they registered and allowing to vote.
Percentage of voter eligible voter turnout, we came across an interesting table. And we had to take a bunch of numbers. Show that in 1960, North Carolina was led all 11 states to vote Confederacy, and percentage of persons eligible to vote who voted in 1972 ranked ninth of those 11 in percentage of eligible voters who were eligible to vote. And only North Carolina and Tennessee had gone down in that period. North Carolina the most, and all the other nine states had all increased. The gap was still, there was still a gap between the South and the nation, but the nation had gone down, the South had gone up. The question is, why did North Carolina in this anomalous position? Why was the voter turnout less in North Carolina percentage-wise? Why was there low voter turnout in North Carolina in the 72 election? Much more so than just a normal fall off you had all over the country because of the governor race. And here you had a hotly contested Senate race, U.S. Senate race, and governor race.
I've heard the hypothesis advanced that the people who were pushing for this sort of thing were sort of reading the key book and reading the press clippings of the Sanford and the Frank Porter Graham and the statistics of 1960, so their attention was elsewhere. And they didn't realize how bad things were really in North Carolina. And so they just didn't direct their attention here.
Who now?
Well, the federal people at the federal level, people who might bring court suit. Various black groups. Nothing that anybody at the North Carolina Fund or who was working in North Carolina state politics who wanted to get the blacks in would suggest that. But that's the only hypothesis I've heard about this.
Or to some extent, North Carolina more than most states in the South was some sort of bypass by the civil rights.
Do you think a large part of that could be attributed to the Sanford administration?
It could be.
It could be just to the progressive image, which may have been true. I'm not sure if it was true or not back then.
Remember, when they were putting the OAO Act together, there were very few people who went up to testify for it and help work out the bill. George Esser from the North Carolina Fund and Terry Sanford went up and did this. So that it was very, very obvious that something was going on. Here's a Southern governor doing this. He had Ford Foundation money to do all these things. You know, at that elite level, he was hitting them with good, positive signals.
This raises another question. What impact, if any, did Sanford have nationally on domestic policy in the country? Did the experience of the North Carolina Fund, was that the forerunner of the anti-poverty program? Did Sanford's programs in education spur the Great Society programs in federal aid and education?
There was interaction there, but it's hard to, you got to balance that off with sort of the legislative history of OEL, where Sanford's making inputs, presenting sort of the political side of what Paul Ilvesacker was trying to get done across the country. At the same time, the North Carolina delegation in Congress, one of the most conservative in Congress, is putting a rider on the OEO legislation or somewhere that Adam Yarmolinsky and some of those people who drafted this bill cannot go to work for OEO. So you have sort of a dual effect of North Carolina in this drafting. In terms of educational reform, I think he was leaned on. Bill Friday got elevated into some of these nationwide commissions. Terry was on some. The White House Commission on Education, Terry was there. And I don't know how much he really put in.
Was there a genuine cause and effect relationship between what Sanford was doing in North Carolina and his administration as governor and what followed as the Great Society program?
That I couldn't say. There were some associations, but some of these things were going on elsewhere, too. Dick Lee in New Haven and some other people were trying various things. Harold Howe goes out of here, though. You know, here's Link. Harold Howe's brought down from Scarsdale, sets up this, a lot of the innovative educational thinking and planning and programs under Sanford, and he becomes Commissioner of Education. You know, how do you measure what's cause and effect? You know, there's some associations involved, and I just can't tell you.
Howe ran the Learning Institute.
Mm-hmm. Right. Which was part of the Sanford campaign to try to get a hold of state government by hitting him upside the head.
It is interesting to go back to how we started this conversation. Think about North Carolina. We got a comment from one of our interviewees that the further away you get away from the state, the better it looks,
mm-hmm.
vice versa. And that when you really start to get below the image. But how has this image been able to be maintained all this time? It really got a shot and got reinforced by Sanford administration.
Mm-hmm.
Since then, it's been, you know, I'd say sort of level caretaker, gradual increments. So really no major social changes, no major agenda setting by anybody. Certainly not by Holes. Mm-hmm. I should ask you that. Give you the opinion. Why does it stay this way?
You know, I don't want to go back to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Frankfort or Graham. Because at some point doesn't make sense, although it does make some sense when people talk about North Carolina sometimes. They pinpoint that.
You mean his race?
No, just Chapel Hill, sort of
the whole liberal
thing, and that's the school that they aspire to go to for graduate training and so forth.
Oh, so are you also saying that Graham just represented
an ethos?
And also a source of stimulation, mm-hmm.
yeah.
went statewide, people went out of here and went back to this little town.
Then there's that, I don't know how much weight to give this, but there is a cadre of people who went through here or out of North Carolina, through here, that ended up in the writing and communication side. Who, you know, it doesn't happen too often, but every once in a while, Wicker will write something out of North Carolina about what's going on, and, you know, the good growth and the good things, and then Brinkley will say something.
Roger Mudd.
And Roger Mudd and Charles Perrault. You know, you go right through. There is some people that have some impact on the way elites think. There are little oases, too, that I think are attractive that catch people's thinking, and it's sort of like the Southern Pines oases, and the mountain oases, and Blue Ridge Parkway, and the coastline. What they don't really see is all the things in between all those oases. You know, driving through the eastern part of the state to get out the coastline just driving crazy if you really look at it and think about it, where you are.
How do you explain the failure of anyone to come to grips politically with the economic problems? I'm really low-ranking, per capita income, lowest manufacturing wage in the country, the domination of manufacturing jobs by tobacco, textiles, furniture, which are all low-wage. The impression I have is very little really populist tradition in North Carolina in that sense. Carr Scott said some elements of it, but his was more get the people out of the mud sort of thing. It was more rural oriented, but nobody dealing with the traditional populist issues in a contemporary sense.
I don't think any politician at this point in the state will be running on making it on a populist thing. I could be wrong, but in terms of the basic part of your first question, how are you going to get the state going? The ones that have attacked that problem and have won elections or gone out with some strength have really focused on, say, the RTI concept, major developments like that. No one's run on you know, increased welfare payments or more job training. You know, Sanford came closest to it. The sort of the trickle-down effect of more money into education,
with all this thing, you know, Luther Hodges bringing in industry, what do you bring in?
Well, you bring in people from the outside who then
research triangle, of course.
Then you stretch your, you know, if you take a look at the research triangle, you got high wage levels. Point that out, but you really don't do anything in the other parts of the state.
That's my question. The research triangle, I think, it has to be sort of overwhelming success, concept implementation. But it affects only one small portion of the state.
Three out of 100 counties.
And Thad, didn't Super Bowl's career education program come as close to that as anything?
Yeah, but for some reason that didn't catch, and I don't know why. You know, it's still being fought, you know, sort of still the classic fight going on over there between Ed Gill and Phillips.
What is Gill's role?
As treasurer, he's the one that really sits on another one of the North Carolina's good things, the bond ratings of all the cities and communities and the state itself, and good fiscal, solid fiscal management.
How much power does he have to influence in state policy?
In state policy, he may through the Board of Education. That fight is still going on, as near as I can tell. He had a hell of a lot more under the Moore administration. He was quite a critical member of that administration.
Is that more
I don't think under
Scott. Advisory capacity, closeness to Moore, Moore depending on him.
I think it was an interpersonal sort of thing. And, he is on the Council of State, but I don't know how much policy is really set at that level. I can't imagine too much. Especially
what is the county
state? It consists of all the statewide elected officers, like the Secretary of State, the Treasurer. Well, that's kind of a cabinet.
And he gets on the Board of Education, I think that's, and he's very vocal there, and that's where he's carrying this battle on with Craig Phillips on career education.
This is on the State Board of Education, which is as opposed to higher education.
That's right. And this is where he focuses.
But he's ex officio member of the State Board of Education?
I can't remember whether he's ex officio, either that or official member. I'm not sure.
I think they may have been because they didn't really know.
But he's been carrying this battle right along. He's back to the old, but not career education, because that's too structured. We want it wide open. Maybe have a small track or a small cul-de-sac in which they can move off into.
Who would be the, if you had to name, who would be the five most influential people in North Carolina?
Most influential people outside of government or just
most? NRL.
I would suppose Archie K would be one. Archie K. Davis, I would suppose he would be.
Who is he?
Head of Wachovia and several other. Certainly has a lot of impact vis-a-vis the Holzhauser administration, since he called on early to head up that economy and efficiency study. He's been head of the National Chamber of Commerce and so forth. I think that he would turn out to be very, very strong. I don't perceive Governor Holzhauser as, you know, aside from his role, I don't see him as that influential. And then I would just, you know, I really would have to get into coin flipping. There's a whole range of people that come out of the various banking groups. There was a study done about 4 or 5 years ago which took the Board of Higher Education, or the Board of Governors in North Carolina, and just found out what sort of interlocking directorates they were on in terms of insurance companies, banks, regular companies. It was a graduate student or an undergraduate student here on campus, and he came up with like four major groupings, and they were all like the NCNB grouping and the Wachovia grouping and the First Citizens grouping, and I think there was...
Anybody who's got a study of that and a copy of that?
I think I do in my file somewhere. It's kind of interesting.
I'd like to see that.
Because then it links into, you know, the insurance companies.
Right.
I'm not really a devotee of a devil theory that says there's four or five guys you got to touch base with. And if there is, then I think that shifts from almost day to day. I think there are some groups of power that you got to work with.
But in tobacco, is there any individual who stands out worse than anyone else?
There may be. I just don't know. I don't follow that closely.
One impression I have by groups in North Carolina that banking would be at the top. Who would be number two?
Sort of group. I think people talk about the insurance industry. There's a lot of insurance power in the state. It may just be because there's two strong insurance companies in the state.
Who's the policy?
And Jefferson Standard. And these are linked into the banking groups.
And who would come behind them?
Well, obviously, I don't know what order, but the textiles are pretty close there.
Tobacco?
That becomes harder. I just, there's some people, whether, Watts Hill still has power, Liggett and Myers, or, who has that sort of power, I don't know. But they would certainly be way up there in terms of those companies. Watts Hill had a hell of a lot of power under Governor Moore.
How about the utilities?
They were linked in. I would say they'd be linked in very, very tightly. And it certainly showed, just on the basis of this one study, that the utility, you could pinpoint where these utilities were in terms of the banking interests.
Who's on the board?
Mm-hmm. If you want to believe in that sort of, which I would guess would make some sense. Not that they're plotting.
My guess is somebody analyzed it in every one of these states, you'd find something closely resembling that. I don't know. Except you'd have different groups. Some states wouldn't have textiles. You know.
But you could.
In Louisiana, you have oil comes in.
Yeah. You could even see, when I remember reading the article, I think it was written in 69 or 68, you could even see where the gubernatorial candidates came from. By the, you could see where the appointments were. Like Governor Moore came out of one of the groups, and Rich Pryor came out of another of the groups, and so forth. Sort of pinpoint that. And I'm sure if you looked at it, you'd see what Skipper sort of had this crowd behind him, and you could say, well, that does make some sense. Not that they get together and say, hey, who's going to be our man?
No, in that case, it was First Union Jefferson Standard.
Yeah. I don't see any strong political leadership right now.
Any strong what?
Political leadership. I think Governor Holzhauser is doing a good job and he's fighting a good battle, but I just don't think there's any way that, he faces the prospect of maybe ending up like Linwood Holton, except he pulled it off this time. And didn't get beaten in his own party. You've got too many Democrats around. They're all out with their knives, stripping bills in the legislature. He makes some moves, and Lieutenant Governor Hunt sets up a commission to come in and start investigating.
So how important were those 74 legislative races? Distinguished Secretary of State of North Carolina yesterday predicted that it was going to be like his first term in the legislature in 1928, when Hoover carried North Carolina and elected 49 Republicans. You know how many got reelected in 1930?
One.
Six.
There.
He thinks you're going to be a repeat.
We can draw the analogy between November 1929 and November 1960.
Yeah. It could very well be because, and this is a very limited sample, but I'm talking with three or four people who have been involved in that Republican fight between Rouse and Bennett. They're very bitter feelings there. I mean, it's going to be hard for them to sit down and work for each other. There may be some sitting on hands saying, well, that's what Holzhauser wants to do, the hell with it.
So you don't see the Republican Party getting stronger in terms of winning more seats?
It could. Yeah, I could posit a hypothesis that I would back up with a whole bunch of data or suggest assertions that would lead to this, that they may just hold where they are.
Can you give us a little briefing on Robert Morgan background? We're going to see him this afternoon. Also, Howard.
We
certainly should avoid not asking you whether.
Well, he's very candid. His personal background.
My knowledge is limited.
Okay. I don't know whether he went to ECU when it was ECTC, but he ended up at Wake Forest Law School. And his mentor there was I. Beverly Lake. And he goes back to a strong personal and academic tie with Beverly Lake. In the 60 campaign, he was a state senator, or at some point he got in the Senate. The 60 campaign, he ran the Beverly Lake campaign. I can't remember whether he did in 64. He may very well have been involved there. I know he was involved with both of them. He is probably the strongest, you know, in terms of Democratic politics, he may be the strongest man in the party in terms of being able to get the vote out. I'm not sure that's true, but I would guess that he might be. He said about 2 weeks ago that he's going to run. And he's gotten his poll. I don't know who's doing his polling.
Peter Hart.
One thing, you know, that has never been explained is that trip that he took to Washington that knocked him out of the 72 race. You know, what caused him to jump out? Of course, the rumor was, I think you probably had this, was that Sam said, don't run for this. You don't want to be a governor. You really want to be a senator. And I'm not going to run again. Why don't you just bide your time and then pick it up in 74?
I'm just asking that question. Whether he got advice from Irvin on this? Yeah, we heard that.
Okay. Yeah. He is very strong that he just does, he's not an executive type and he doesn't want to be governor. And he had just come from a meeting with Governor Holzhauser, and he said it's just impossible. The amount of time the guy has to think and do things. And he said, that's not my style. He said, I'm a legislative type. Like contemplative life in the U.S. Senate looks like the place I should be. And the further this.
Where is he philosophically? My understanding is his relationship with Lake isn't personal.
There are some philosophical correlations, though. But he is more moderate than I, Beverly Lake.
But is he still a close associate of his?
Yes. At least he said he was. Maybe it wasn't close associate. Maybe the question that one of the students asked was, do you still consider Mr. Lake a close friend and associate or something like that? And he said, absolutely. With no bones about the answer.
As we progress on this thing, I'm turning out rough drafts and whatnot. Are you willing to take a look at them?
Sure.
Or meet just occasionally and talk about them?
I'd be glad to.
I would like this if you happen to dig up that power.
Yeah, I'll have to dig back in my files on that one.
How about Howard Lee?
What sort of fellow?
Really, background.
You know, he comes out of Georgia. He was a member of, I think, a fairly large family, poor. One time, one of the ways he got out of Georgia was joining one of those gospel singing groups. And he still can sing very well, and I've heard him sing good old gospel type music. And then he somehow ended up in North Carolina getting a degree in social work and then working at Duke and then trying to get an appointment over here. And that got into a big fight, and he lost out, and so he ended up at Duke. And then decided to run for the mayorship. It's obviously a step. And,
what was he doing up there?
I think he was sort of brought in to try to take care of that black question in the staff side, not on the faculty side. There's a real severe segregation problems at Duke. You know, Duke has always been known as sort of the last bastion of white conservatism in the state. When the university integrated here, then some of the people could send their kids to Duke because that was still, at that point, segregated. At least this was sort of what people would say. He debated the last time around whether he was going to run for Secretary of Labor, Congress, or not at all. And I think he was offered by whoever the slate maker is the position on the slate for Secretary of Labor. And he turned that aside and ran for Congress. What I hear is that he's gearing up again, but this time probably for the lieutenant governorship. A major statewide.
Is that a realistic goal?
In my view.
What, you mean for the nomination?
For getting elected?
Well,
or the nomination.
My view, it is.
It is not?
Yeah, you know, I really don't see that in North Carolina right now. I'll work you know, and all that. But I just don't see the... up to Hillsborough. I don't have to get far out of Chapel Hill before I feel the breath.
Saturday. Well, you can come to Riceville Beach. We don't have a black problem there.
Blacks there. I sat on a murder jury last week. Three blacks went into a situation, and one of them came out dead. And so it was no racial overtone, but I sat on the jury. No blacks on the jury. And I just sat there and I said, do I want to enter the debate now, or shall I just shut up and we'll vote? Because they were making all sorts of those sort of subtle racist comments. Like, you know, the fellow had been killed in the cemetery just before dark, and then they went back in the morning. Someone said, well, maybe one of them went back, or someone else came in the cemetery and did the guy in. Someone said, you know that race, they don't go into cemeteries at night. And there was a constant sort of patois just sat there. No, I don't want to do battle. And these were some good friends from Chapel Hill, Orange County, the Lip of Bastion, North Carolina.
How much did the passing of Graham change North Carolina?
How much what?
You know, you always hear people talk about the influence of Frank Willard Graham's influence in the state. I never hear anyone talk about the influence of Bill Friday and his impact on the state.
I don't think it's the same. It's obviously not the same. I think Bill Friday's forte is something entirely different. I think his major fortes are administration and the politics in the administration and vis-a-vis the state legislature. I've never heard anybody say anything other than he's one of the most artful politicians the state has. But he is not sort of... The thing that Frank Porter Graham had was probably a lot of that, but sort of the intellectual stimulation that he gave to the faculty and the students near him. Plus, it was a small school that, you know, 4,000 students and 5,000 students, and everybody could know Dr. Frank. We got 20,000 people wandering around up here. We almost have as many faculty as they had students at that point. So the impact of a president could be much greater.